Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program.
You're listening to Noel Debien on Sunday nights.
And on ABC Radio around Australia, it's time for Signpost. This week, we're fortunate enough to have Andrew West, host of the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National, who keeps across all of the current religious issues, particularly the Australian stuff and as it relates to Australia. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Noel.
So this week, it's been, if anybody follows the religious press or have been looking at stuff in the paper, the Vatican so-called Synod on the Family starts, doesn't it, this week?
Yes, it began today. It will continue for the next 2 weeks.
I think there's been a bit of to and fro about this, but there's even some married couples invited to take part, I think.
Yes, there was a lot of controversy when the notion of a synod on the family to be attended almost exclusively by celibate males, by bishops and cardinals, not people with an intimate knowledge of family life, other than having grown up in families, that they were to be there almost in isolation. Now, the Vatican announced a week or so ago that 14 married couples, four Australians among them, would join the mostly 240 bishops and clerics at this synod on the family.
Now, I recognise some of the names because the Parolas were very famous in setting up the Antioch movement in Australia. Very well-known Catholic couple around this country. The point is, though, I think that only bishops still vote. And some Catholic friends have pointed out to me, well, it's a synod. Only bishops get a vote on synods.
That's right. 192 bishops will have a vote on the formal proceedings. There'll be 25 women participating, but they will be in a non-voting role. And there's no doubt that the families and the married couples that are attending are people who are very prominent in Catholic life. An observation, I won't go so far as to say a criticism, but an observation made is that they tend to be married couples with a very orthodox, strictly Catholic and traditional position on issues such as natural family planning. And there are dissenters who are saying, or doubters even, and we're talking here about people like the former President of Ireland, Mary McAleese, the former Premier of New South Wales, Christina Keneally.
You've had them both on the program talking about this.
Indeed. They are arguing that no matter how distinguished and how devout these lay couples are from around the world, they're unlikely to dissent from Catholic teaching on the issue, for example, of birth control or contraception. And they're asking, really, if you're only having married couples there to affirm the current position, you know, what's this synod all about? I mean, I think there's a lot of goodwill towards Pope Francis, a lot of goodwill towards what he hopes might be a breakthrough as far as reaching out to different family types. But if you're not really going to have voices there with a history of dissent, then maybe the synod itself has reached its conclusions before it opens.
Well, as you know, the Catholic Church has not been very keen on dissent since the Reformation. In fact, earlier. But I think the point here, though, is that when you look at contraception in particular, since Humanae Vitae, which is, what, 50 years ago nearly, or just on 50 years ago, that when Paul VI did that, we've had a situation where most Catholics have ignored it. And the issue that's been raised here is about divorce and remarriage, in line with, for example, what Orthodox churches do, where they do permit a second marriage. It's not supposed to be quite as fabulous as the first one. It's slightly penitential, but you are allowed to have a second and a third. And these are the issues that have been raised. They're not dissenting issues. They're actually issues not about just protest, are they? They're actually about, well, look, this is really how most Catholics experience life. They've got these people in their families.
And quite interestingly, earlier this year, Pope Francis, in an extended interview that he gave to the Jesuit press, I think it may have been this year, but also repeating themes that he raised in his first year as Pope, said, look, what do we do about the woman who had a failed first marriage, but has gone on to be, if you like, the model Catholic mother with a family of five, but somewhere in her background was an ill-considered failed first marriage? Should this woman be excluded from the sacraments of the church? Should she be excluded from a full life in the church? The Pope, I think, definitely wants a more compassionate and accommodating position on that. That is what the Synod on the Family is supposed to address. I guess the doubters are saying you really do need, though, people who are more reflective and at times critical of church teaching and church doctrine, and that you probably won't get that with the current group of lay people, however respected they are, who are attending.
There'll be Catholics who say that a synod is about reaffirming Catholic doctrine, and because they're writing quite happily on social media and they're talking about it. And yet there are bishops and cardinals sending out letters saying that they want the status quo maintained. Why do you say, just for somebody who may not have kept up with all this, why do you say that this synod is meant to look at alternatives? Why look at alternatives rather than reaffirm?
Well, I'm not sure that it is exactly meant to look at alternatives. We can only go on what the Pope has said, where he has spoken about a more capacious and more compassionate attitude to people who don't measure up at times to the very strict standards that traditionally the Church has set.
Well, this is a Pope who has a lot to say on a lot of topics, and he's certainly captured a lot of attention. One thing he has spoken about is terrorism, deplored it. He's been in Albania, pointing out that Albanians live together in a diverse religious community. He's praised them for it. But still, this week, most of our attention is actually focused on the international campaign against the Islamic State still. It's still going. You've been looking at this in a recent report on the making of jihadists.
Yes, a very interesting report, quite recent, from the Lowy Institute for International Policy, called Next Gen Jihad in the Middle East, by one of their top experts, Anthony Bubalo, a former diplomat in the region in Saudi Arabia and also in Israel. He's pointing out, and this is pretty alarming, that the conditions that drive jihadists, the social conditions, the historic conditions, the impulses, are worse today than they were in the lead up to the 9/11 attacks in 2001, the Twin Towers attacks. Yes. If you go back to the prelude to 9/11, what did you have? You had a generation of jihadis who had been mobilized and energized by the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s. Mm. Now, we were talking there about 4,000 people, according to this report from the Lowy Institute. Now, what did they learn in Afghanistan? First of all, they learned violent forms of resistance. They learned warfare, bomb making, etc.
War practice.
But even more importantly, Noel, they learned to be networked. And that meant that they carried these networks with them, these linkages, these connections through the conflicts in the 1990s in Chechnya and Bosnia. And that, as I say, carried them through. These were the sort of cadres that created what happened in 9/11. And of course, they were also motivated by a grievance against the United States for being present in the Islamic Holy Lands in Saudi Arabia. What do we have today, post 9/11? According to this report, we've got more than twice the number of jihadists, foreign jihadists, fighting in Syria and Iraq.
8,000 or 9,000 you're talking about.
Up to 14,000 maybe. Extraordinary numbers. And again, groups of people who are similarly networked. So it's a very important point that he makes. The second warning that he makes in this report, Next Gen Jihad, is don't ignore Egypt. Because Egypt, since al-Sisi took over, has sort of dropped off the radar. People think, well, it's under control. We have that very unfortunate situation with journalists being jailed in Egypt. But other than that, Egypt has sort of dropped off our radar. Don't forget Egypt, he warns, because Egypt not only is the birthplace of a lot of jihadist thinking, it's also a place where Islamists were told, put aside the notion of violent revolutionary takeover. Use the democratic process. Well, what did the Muslim Brotherhood do? In Egypt, it entered into the democratic process.
It won and then they suppressed it.
It won. Now, it went too far in many ways. Morsi was a far more authoritarian leader than was promised. And indeed, the Muslim Brotherhood had said, we won't contest the presidency. Although when they saw that the Salafists, even further to their right in religious terms, were going to contest the presidency, they thought, well, we better contest it. But nonetheless, the Islamists thought, well, we'll play the democratic game. They were toppled from power. They've been suppressed. There's now a certain sense, according to Anthony Bubalo, of I told you so among the jihadists who are off to the sort of religious religious right.
Don't trust democracy.
Don't trust democracy. Yeah. So this is something that we should not take our eye off, and that is the situation in Egypt.
Well, luckily for you and me, we follow Ruth Pollard, the Fairfax correspondent who's been in and out of Egypt.
She has, across the entire region.
Well, a left-hand turn. In just a moment, we'll be talking to, in our second hour here, Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk, who's the Ukrainian patriarch of the Catholic Church in Ukraine, the Greek Catholic Church. He's mainly a spiritual leader, I suppose, but like all of these religious leaders in this area, the church has been politicized because it also gets identified along national lines, pro-European, pro-Russian. It has become politicized, hasn't it?
Well, to the extent that the Archbishop himself has said that in the pews of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, they are raising money for the troops. Now, he's been very particular.
But not weapons, I believe.
Well, that's right. He's been very particular about saying, we don't buy weapons. But what do they buy? Well, we buy helmets, body armour, so defensive equipment, but nonetheless military equipment along with food and medical support. So money is being raised in Greek Catholic churches for the army, for the Ukrainian National Army. Now, he says, he's very particular about it, we're not buying arms, we're not buying weapons, but we're buying helmets and body armour. So they're certainly buying defensive equipment as well as medicines and bandages and food and things like that.
Now, that army is 70% Orthodox, though, of course, because the Ukrainian right is only 10%.
Yeah, 10 to 15%, I think. You're talking about 5 million Ukrainian Greek Catholic.
But the point is that he is saying that they are actually raising money for defensive stuff, and the church is supplying. But the interesting thing here is that the Orthodox and the Catholics are united, actually, on this front.
Some of the Orthodox. This is a very important point that you raise. The Orthodox Church, not the Greek Catholic Church, but the Orthodox Church is split three ways. Now,
even more, but three main splits.
Yeah, three main ways. Now, nominally speaking, the largest group is aligned to the Moscow Patriarch, to Archbishop Kirill in Moscow.
Officially it is, but it's actually a supporting independence.
Yes, and then there's another group that split off in 1991, and they are aligned to the Patriarch of Kiev. And then if you go back all the way to 1921, there's another smaller group that's also split off, an Orthodox group. So the Orthodox are split three ways, with one of their wings nominally aligned to Moscow. Now, of course, this has caused a problem.
And speaking as if it's straight from Moscow too. It's not just aligned. It's almost like a spokesman
Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, they recognise Archbishop Kirill as their patriarch. Now, the problem that you've got there is that he has been saying, essentially, the party line out of Moscow from Putin. The New York Times reported recently that you've got situations where Orthodox clergy aligned to the Moscow Patriarch have been hoarding weapons for the rebel-backed, the Russian-backed rebels over in the East. They've been using the churches to hoard weapons. They've been going out blessing the rebels and blessing their soldiers. So the churches on all sides in the Ukraine have been quite politicized.
As far as I understand, if I'm right, though, it's like roughly 80% of the population, certainly in the East, both Orthodox and Catholic and Protestant as well, because there's Protestants there and there's Muslims as well in the Crimea, that they're actually pro-independence, but maybe 20% of the church is saying we're pro-Russian and we don't want independence, basically.
Yes, that's correct. If it's the Ukraine, it's complicated, Noel.
Well, thank you for that, though. I mean, it at least does make it a little clearer, and the Patriarch will be along very shortly to put his position. And speaking of politicised religion, a great and well-known man has died, the Reverend Ian Paisley. Wherefore gods and plaster statues, I seem to remember him saying. Why was he such a significant figure? Remind us, politically and religiously.
Well, you've contentiously described him as a great figure. Now, maybe in the latter part of his life, he would be considered a great figure because, you know, well into his 70s and early 80s, Ian Paisley finally became a reconciler. But for many years, of course, he was a fire-breathing, highly sectarian, anti-Catholic Protestant leader. leader. He was extreme in so many ways. He was extreme in terms of his own church. He broke away from the official Presbyterian church to found his own local Free Presbyterian church.
Firebrand, basically.
He broke away from the main loyalist forces in Northern Ireland to found the Democratic Unionist Party. So in so many ways, politically and theologically, he was extreme. He used to delight in referring to the popes as old Red Sox. When he was elected to the European Parliament, and interestingly, he held about three elected offices at the same time. He was a member of the House of Commons. He was a member of the European Parliament, and for a while he was a member of the Northern Ireland Assembly, which was where he ultimately became Chief or First Minister. But when he was in the European Parliament, back in 1988-89, when Pope John Paul II addressed the European Parliament, he screamed at the Pope and had to be ejected, saying, "You are the Antichrist." Long after the official Presbyterian Church in Northern Ireland and in Scotland, removed from its statement of confession this phrase, "We consider the Pope the Antichrist," long after it had removed it, the Free Presbyterians of Northern Ireland had maintained that theological position.
So Paisley was maintaining the progressive Catholic line all the way. There you go.
But the interesting point about him is he ultimately came to an extraordinary reconciliation, and again, not with the sort of moderate nationalist Irish forces, not with the Social Democratic and Labour Party, but with Sinn Féin. Who became his deputy first minister? It was Martin McGuinness.
That's right.
And so much so.
There's so much love in the room.
Well, they came to be known as the so-called Chuckle Brothers in the last two or three years of Paisley's life, because whenever they were seen together, they'd be laughing and patting each other on the shoulder. And I think they reached, there was certainly a sense that they recognised each other's common humanity, but other experts have pointed out this. They also recognised each other's passion and principle. Now, it was a principle that both sides took to extremes. There were violent loyalists and there were violent nationalists. But they both recognised in each other, he's a hardliner, I'm a hardliner. We really believe in this stuff. So maybe there was a certain sense of two people with solidly principled positions, principled almost to the point, and often to the point of violence, but nonetheless, they recognised in each other that sense of principle.
So the Reverend Ian Paisley departed this mortal coil.
He did.
Finally, former US President Jimmy Carter turned 90, a healthy age, this week. He's the subject of a new biography that comes at his life from a fairly unique angle.
Yes, Randall Barmer, one of America's most celebrated historians, historian at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, has written a new book called Redeemer. Now, it's a book with a lovely double meaning. What does he look at in Carter's life? He looks at the persistent strength of faith. He argues that Jimmy Carter may well have been the most religious man ever to lead the United States. He was a very committed evangelical Christian. He was a Democrat. And in many ways, he was quite a progressive Democrat, especially later on issues like civil rights and women's rights.
Yeah.
But what does the reference to Redeemer really mean? Well, there was an argument, of course, that when people voted for Carter in 1976, they were trying to redeem themselves by having voted twice for Richard Nixon. Not so much a regret about their first vote in 1968, but a lot of people, even after the sort of early details of Watergate had come out, still voted for Nixon in 1972, and that Randall Barmer says that by pulling the lever for Jimmy Carter in 76, they were trying to redeem themselves, they were trying to redeem America.
So he's arguing that Tricky Dick is the gift that keeps on giving.
The second thing, however, he was saying was that Carter saw the presidency as a way to redeem himself. Because when Carter became governor of Georgia in 1970...
Peanut farmer, wasn't he? Do I remember?
Well, a little bit more than that. Yeah. I mean, he'd actually involved himself in nuclear physics. He's a very, very intelligent man. But when he ran for the governorship of Georgia in 1970, he'd made his own pact with the devil, and that was the Carter family had always had a very good record on race relations.
Yeah.
Coming from Georgia, it was a tough thing to be to recognise racial equality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, what Carter did was effectively in 1970, having lost a previous vote, a previous campaign for the governorship, basically courted the old segregationist vote. And he'd told a bunch of civil rights leaders during the campaign, you're going to hate how I campaign, but you're going to love how I govern. So he campaigned in a way that was not really true to his background, to his family history of racial equality and civil rights. But as governor, in his very first speech, inaugural speech as governor, he said the time for segregation is over. Well, carrying that through with a governorship and then into the presidency, he saw holding both the governorship and the presidency as a chance to redeem himself. So Carter was an extremely religious man. I mean, he prayed sometimes 25 times a day. Now, often these would be 10-second prayers as he was walking into a meeting with his Secretary of State.
It's,
oh, God, give me the forbearance to deal with my Secretary of State.
Called ejaculatory prayer, I might say, by specialists.
Not a phrase that I've heard before, Noel. But the other thing about Carter was that he built his presidency on a 1973 statement by a group of evangelicals about progressive evangelicalism. And it really defies, I guess, our sort of cliched understanding of evangelicals in America today. This statement of belief brought out in Chicago in 1973 by this group of evangelical leaders emphasized racial equality. It emphasized gender equality. It emphasized peace. Remember, this is in the context of the Vietnam War. It emphasized greater economic fairness. This became the basis of Carter's campaign. Now, Carter had a deeply imperfect presidency. In many ways, he's considered an heroic failure. He was beset by a lot of crises. But the thing that kept him going was not just his personal religious faith, not just his idea that I am a born-again Christian, but that extra historic evangelical belief that society can be born again, that it's not just my personal saviour, despite what the cliched image is, that it is my chance to redeem a fallen world. And in America, the fallen world was of slavery, was of Jim Crow, was of women's oppression, was of economic inequality. Carter saw himself as redeeming this part of America as well.
Amen to that, brother. Andrew West, host of the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National. Thanks for being part of the program.
Always our pleasure.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.